Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Where does wisdom come from, and what do we have to live through in order to earn it? Writer Henry Alford's latest book grew out of his fascination with the fact that humans tend to live decades beyond the age at which they give birth and even raise children. The evolutionary purpose for that, he reasoned, must be that people develop keen and valuable insight over the course of long lives that the elderly might share with the rest of us if we are wise enough to pay attention. So he interviewed more than 100 people over the age of 70, and he explains some of what he learned in his new book, How to Live, A Search for Wisdom from Old People While They Are Still on This Earth. Henry, welcome to Think.
Thanks, Chris.
Are elderly people actually different from the rest of us who've come around just a bit later?
I think they are. I was fascinated to find out that that there's medical evidence that supports this cliche that old people are indeed wiser. Prior to the 1970s, it was sort of thought that one's intellectual decline as one aged was a slow and gradual process. But as it turns out, it's not really. It turns out that you maintain most of your neural integrity, and it's not until you get very close to your demise that there's a sharp decline. This is, of course, I'm talking in generalizations. Of course, this is not specific to people who have neurological.
Sure. And there is some interesting evidence in the book that there are some things we get much better at as we get older.
I think so, absolutely. I think that there's one of the things that psychologists talk about is pattern recognition, this idea that that we go through things in life and we enact things over and over again, and it takes some of us a longer time to just realize that we keep making the wrong mistake. We keep being drawn to the same kind of person.
You have a great story in the book about an Indonesian fisherman who saved thousands of people from the tsunami in 2004.
Isn't he amazing? That's my favorite. I think he's my favorite.
Of the whole book?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in the book. He's this is the Mokan tribe in Indonesia, and these folks learn to swim before they walk, and they can hold their breath underwater twice as long as most humans. So they have it's almost like an animal intelligence. It's, you know, they're more intuitive than you or I would be. And yeah, on the morning of the tsunami in 2003, this guy noticed all these harbingers of doom. He saw that the tide was being pulled out more quickly than ever. He noticed that the buzzing of the cicadas on the land, went down in volume very quickly, and he alerted his tribe members and told them to climb a local mountain, and in so doing, he saved literally thousands of lives.
You know, though, what's so striking about that story, Henry, is that was a culture where they would listen to this very elderly man who just woke up with a feeling about something, and I wonder if our culture would be that sensitive.
It's true. No, I don't think we would. And that's something that you find when you look into wisdom, is that obviously the more rural and the more agrarian the society, the more they respect their elders.
Is there an East-West divide in the way we perceive the aging process and the value that it brings?
Well, there's definitely there's an East-West divide in terms of how we perceive wisdom. Here in the West, we link it to linear thinking and knowledge, whereas in the East, wisdom is much more, you would describe, it's closer to our word, intuition. It's more about the process rather than the result.
What did you think would come of this project when you started it?
Well, I never thought that what would happen with what happened with my mother and stepfather would happen. I thought that I would learn a lot about the cultural differences or cultural ideas and wisdom. And that's sort of why I set out to interview all these people over 70. What happened was, early on in the process, I interviewed my mom and stepfather, and my stepfather was so dark in his interview that I asked him, wait a minute, you're not talking about, and he said, no, I would never do that to my children. And then the next day, he overdosed. So he did not kill himself, but because he had had troubles with his sobriety in the past, my mother, who had been with him 31 years, this time around said, hey, I'm so sorry, but I simply can't do this again. And she divorced him at the age of 80. And that's a really unusual time in life to be making that kind of a big decision. And so what ends up happening in the book is it ends up being about half of it is a family memoir, as I keep coming back to my mother and stepfather and following them through this series of very complicated and difficult changes in their relationship.
Yeah, I wonder if you've reflected on the idea that as you're sort of documenting what happens to them at what is probably close to the end of their lives, relatively speaking, mm-hmm. Is also related to what amounts to a midlife crisis for you.
Oh, well, I'm only 46, Chris, so give me a few years on the midlife crisis.
Well, people define midlife, you know, in different ways. Some people say it's 40 and some people say it's, you know, 55 or 60.
It's true. And these classifications are very murky. So I'm sorry, you're asking, was their breakup, did I see it as the equivalent to
I don't know. Did you have a sense sort of the stage of life? Did that magnify for you the stage of life that you were in as compared with them?
Oh, absolutely. I think that any time that kind of a catastrophe or a very dramatic occurrence happens, especially in your family, yeah, you can't help but compare it to your own situation. I'm not sure that mine was specific to my age, but certainly I looked at my relationship and gave it a good long inspection, as I know my siblings did as well. The fact that it occurred so late in my mother's life, I think her age really was a huge factor. I don't think she would have made this decision had it happened when she was 50, say, or 60.
Did you have any sense that sort of opening Pandora's box, you going to talk to them, was a catalyst for the events that took place?
Well, my stepfather was a very dramatic, maybe you might even say gothic person. And so in retrospect, sure, I've wondered if he didn't see this moment of being interviewed as an opportune time to make this very dramatic gesture. It's very possible. I was very trepidatious about pursuing it as a storyline in my book, but as it turns out, it's really the part of the book that people, especially book clubs, have responded to, because everyone can relate to this. Everyone has parents who are older, and most of us, or you know, most of our parents are coming to this point where there's going to be a big decision. Are they going to stay at home for their old age, or are they going to go into some kind of a assisted living facility? And in my mother's case, she chose to sell my stepfather her house after the divorce, and then, yeah, we put her into an assisted living facility.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that you conclude with, which I find it on the one hand very pragmatic and very real, and on the other hand sort of chilling, as someone in my 30s, is sometimes you can't know until you are very old that you've chosen the wrong person to grow old with.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a dark reality of life. And it's interesting that one of the people I interviewed was Edward Albee, the playwright, and he said, wisdom is knowing what to overlook. And that's something that people in long-term relationships talk about a lot. And in fact, studies that psychologists have done bear that out as well, that the folks who remain in long-term relationships often are the people who know how to overlook their spouse's, shall we say, eccentricities, for want of a better word, that as we grow old, we learn, you know, how big a deal is it that your spouse slurps his coffee in the morning? It really irritates you, but is that something that's going to be 30 seconds of irritation every morning for the rest of your life that will then go away by, you know, by 10 a.m.? Or is that something that's going to build and build? And, yeah, I think, you know, that's a very tiny example, but I think that as we get older, we see these patterns, and we get to know ourselves better, and we know I can tolerate A, I can tolerate B, but I cannot tolerate C.
What was your sense, Henry, as you talked to people over and over and over, when you got a sense of what their personal wisdom was or their philosophies, was it mostly formed by looking at themselves and their own behavior, or did it tend to be the ability to size up other people?
I think it's usually a product of self-reflection. With a few examples of, you know, the people who have written about wisdom, you know, and those are folks like I talked to the Yale professor and literary critic Harold Bloom. He's someone who's read a lot of wisdom literature, so he would be an exception. But no, I think for most people, it's a process of looking at one's own mistakes and realizing here's where it went awry. You know, I think so many of the lessons that we learn in life, Chris, are cliches. You know, they're things that you've been told all your life. It's simply that when you are in the moment and you arrive at that realization, suddenly the cliche has all this meaning. You know, it doesn't seem like a cliche because you've come at it from such a specific path that, and I think that that's where the wisdom kicks in. It's that moment of recognition where you said, "Oh, when I befriend that kind of person, it always ends up this, you know, in this way."
So do you think that speaks to the idea that wisdom can't really be passed down? You know, people who are older and wise can tell us things all day long, but until we have had that experience, we really don't relate.
Well, yeah, that's a great question. I think there is wisdom that can be passed on, you know, be it orally or through literature. And I think it does have meaning, even though you haven't lived it. But I think if you've lived through a realization, or if you've overcome some kind of adversity and had an epiphany as a result of it, yeah, that's a wisdom that's really going to stay with you.
Writer Henry Alford is my guest. We're talking about his new book. It's called How to Live, A Search for Wisdom from Old People While They Are Still on This Earth. If you want to join us, you can send an email to think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses beginning in January. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Henry Alford. His new book is called How to Live, A Search for Wisdom from Old People While They Are Still on This Earth. You can join the conversation by sending email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. How did you go about structuring your interviews with all the people that you sort of culled through for the book?
Well, let's see. It was really pretty easy to think of people who I wanted to talk to. I had an initial list of about 300 people, and I winnowed it down by asking myself, is this someone who gets a lot of opportunities to talk about their wisdom? So I knocked out a couple of people that way, like the Dalai Lama. And then I took out a lot of show business people only because, again, yeah, they get a lot of opportunity to talk.
And Bill Cosby turned you down, we should say, which was surprising to me.
It was, yes, he did, and so did Don Rickles. They were among the few, showbiz people who I thought might have something really intriguing to say. Not everyone wanted to get on the wisdom train.
Were people sort of ready to talk about this? Had they been waiting for someone to come along and be a receptive audience?
I think people are very flattered to be asked to talk about their wisdom. So that's on the upside. The slight reluctance comes from the fact that, I'm asking people really to dig pretty deep and to talk about difficult stuff in their lives. So that's... that can be hard. One of the closing chapters is a woman who lost her husband and her home in Katrina, and then found out that she would get no insurance. She's a retired school teacher who actually lives just outside of Houston, and she was amazing. She talked to me for almost 4 hours. Her optimism and idealism in the face of this series of blows that life has dealt her were so moving to me that I literally was holding back my tears during the interview. And she sang gospel songs to me, and it just, I realized, look, I'm a total stranger to this woman. I'm asking her really hard questions, but she really meant me. She really gave of herself.
Did you meet anyone who maybe was not included in the book that did not strike you as especially wise? It was just an idiot, and you thought, wow, I guess this is not something that everybody acquires.
Well, there's quite a bit of unwisdom out there, indeed. That's for sure. I didn't meet anyone who was an idiot. I had one person who actually was a very funny interview and unusual interview, but who then asked me twice for money. And legitimate journalists don't take money for interviews. And that was an instance where I thought, okay, well, that is a form of unwisdom. That's someone who's not playing by the rules. One of the principles I talk about of wisdom is discretion, which, again, speaks to this idea of knowing what to overlook. And if you can't, there's this idea that, to be a wise person, you sort of need to know when not to act or what not to do. And I felt that asking for money was indiscreet.
I think that my favorite quote in the book comes from this woman, Granny D, who became a political activist in her late 80s. And she says something like, if you're afraid of death, you're afraid of life.
Yeah, she's an amazing woman. She walked across the country in support of campaign finance reform at the age of 89. She spent 14 months doing it. She had severe emphysema, arthritis in her legs and her elbows, a hearing aid, and dentures, and yet did this, walked the entire way, including through a huge snowstorm at the end. And, Yeah, she was very articulate about having accepted death. And that was one of the surprises of the book, were that there were a number of people who point blank said to me, "I'm in a rush." And you know, that sort of, not, I don't want to say crotchety, but that there's a sense of urgency to some older folks, that there, you know, there's a sense of impatience. I had always chalked that up to bodily ills, or maybe to a sense of entitlement. But no, in fact, it turns out that a large percentage of older folks are conscious of their, you know, impending demise, and as a result, they are trying to get things done.
Mm-hmm. How much did you sense that older folks are thinking about their own death?
Well, it really varied, you know, and I think that's where your the medical ailments or the medical conditions of folks really plays a factor. I think if you're in good health, I'd be very hard pressed to put figures to it, but yeah, I would say that the medical part of it plays a big factor.
Do you think that we need wisdom in order just to sort of survive the inevitable indignities of our bodies growing older?
Oh, yeah. Don't you?
Yeah. I mean, it makes sense that at least we get that, you know, when other things are not working the way they used to.
Yeah, no, exactly. That's the irony or the beauty of aging, is that I really do think that, you know, intellectually and spiritually, that old age is a time of self-fulfillment. People really come into their own late in life. But the irony is that it's happening when you look your worst, you feel your worst. I'm sort of a culture nut, and it's really interesting to me to look out at the cultural landscape and see folks like Joan Didion, or Philip Roth, or Calvin Trillin, or there's an avant-garde composer named Elliot Carter, or Edward Albee. These are all folks who most critics agree, are doing the best work of their careers. And, you know, I'm 46, they're all over 70. That, for me to make that realization, to realize that people over 70, that other people in my field, you know, those are mostly writers that I mentioned, that they're all at the peak of their games, that totally changes my life. Hmm. You know, for me to realize, oh, I've got another 30, you know, 25, 30 years to be as good as they are.
Do you believe in collective wisdom?
How do you mean?
I don't know. I'm wondering, I guess, are we benefiting as a human race from tens of thousands of years of interactions with our elders, or does every generation have to start all over again and sort of live it to believe it?
Oh, that's really interesting. It's a great question. I wish, of course, that we were benefiting more from collective wisdom. You know, my fear is that we, as a culture, we aren't paying as much attention to older folks as we could. There's an old African saying that runs, the death of an old person is like the burning of a library. Hmm. I'm very conscious of that fact that you know, you can point at a whole number of factors as to why it's happened, but yeah, increasingly we pay less and less attention to what older folks have to tell us, and I think that the ideal way for that to happen, yes, would be collectively, would be as a culture. Maybe that's what I'm getting at with these folks like Joan Didion and Philip Roth, who are, you know, who are writing about this stuff and who are tackling these bigger questions. Maybe that's how we can celebrate elder wisdom collectively.
Do you think if you had taken on the same project and spoken to the same people when you were 26 as opposed to 46, you would have written a really different book?
I don't think, you know, interestingly, I'm not sure I would have been as interested in the topic. I think that my mother's age and, yeah, and I guess my own age and maybe even the age of my older siblings made me realize, subconsciously or not, that, yeah, that there are some changes coming up ahead for all of us. So I think when you're 26, you just have no sense whatsoever of mortality. You're larger than life and
trying to make the car payments.
Exactly. I think I'm not sure I would have even tackled the project at that age.
I think it's very interesting as you go through this, and there are a lot of frank conversations that you have with your mother about a lot of different things. And is that the sort of thing that you were always able to speak easily about? Or is there this sense that, you know, with time at a premium, at least for your mom, that some of these conversations need to be had now or they won't happen?
There was a sense, definitely, that we need to have some of these conversations because of her age. She's an unusual case only because she's a bit of a blurter. it's on her mind, it's on her tongue. Candor is the least of her problems. And I say that as tactfully as I can. Certainly with older folks, well, like there's an interview with a woman who was a Japanese-American woman who was in an internment camp. And when she and I sat down, she told me this whole story about the family that she lived with when she got sprung from her internment camp that she had only ever told one person before. And this is a woman who is 86. She's a sociologist. She's doing a big study on folks who've been in internment camps. And, yeah, absolutely. The fact that she is of a certain age has been that's sort of opened the floodgates, as it were. It's made her much more open about talking about some of this stuff.
You spent a good amount of time hanging out with Sandra Lowe's father, who people may have heard stories about on public radio. Can you talk about him a little bit? And about it was interesting, sort of the take that you had on him as opposed to the rest of his family.
Yeah, he's Eugene Lowe is a retired aerospace engineer, and he is a nut. This is a fellow who uses a battered a breakfast cereal box as his briefcase, and he's someone who is a dumpster diver. That is to say, he's harvesting a lot of the food that he eats out of dumpsters.
And he is not without the resources to purchase these things.
Yeah. No, this is not based in poverty. He likes to do this stuff. And I'd heard these stories from Sandra, and I had always thought, oh, well, you know, that's sort of comic. This is a comedic take on the situation. It really can't be that severe. But no, it is definitely as bizarre as she paints a picture of. And he's someone who, when Sandra was young, that this guy was he liked to hitchhike. So he would hide Sandra behind a bush, and then he would stick his thumb out, and a car would stop, and then he would grab Sandra, and the two of them would jump in the car. And it makes for a wonderful anecdote, but then you think, wow, what would it be like to be a teenager and have your father do that? Or what would it be like to be a teenager, you know, which is sort of the high point of your social awkwardness, you be a teenager and have your father pulling bananas out of a dumpster behind a grocery store.
what sort of wisdom do you take from somebody who is, by the admission of everyone who knows and loves him, sort of a kook?
Well, he's definitely following his own muse.
Uh-huh.
That's certainly a kind of wisdom. And I think he has a kind of wisdom about dealing with his children. That story is complicated only because since Sandra has now written about him a lot, he's sort of become part of her repertoire. So his feeling now is, look, I'm providing her great material.
So he's fully conscious of this being the next piece on This American Life.
Exactly.
Another person that you had that you spoke to was Martin Marty, who we've had on the show, and I was not aware of his thoughts on napping when I interviewed him. I only wish that I had known this before.
Yeah, it's fascinating that he thinks that napping is a form of prayer because it's a moment when you are you have a kind of stillness and you shut down all of the frustrations and the anxieties and all these questions that make your super ego and your id throb daily. That it's a time of quiet contemplation.
And he's got it down to a science in terms of how much time it should take.
He does, yeah. You should go to his website. It's kind of fascinating because there's a whole section on if you have Martin Marty as a speaker. And indeed, he requires a 20-minute nap before the lecture. And then he also has this whole thing about he sometimes sleeps with a stopwatch on his wristwatch. And he will sometimes put that on his forehead so that he can have the perfect length of prayer.
He knows just when to get up.
Right.
Henry Alford is here. We're talking about his new book, How to Live, A Search for Wisdom from Old People While They Are Still on This Earth. We would love to have you contribute to the conversation. Give us a call. Share some wisdom of your own or of someone you care about. 1-800-933-5372 is the number. You can also email us at think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses beginning in January. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Writer Henry Alford is my guest. His newest book is called How to Live, A Search for Wisdom from Old People While They Are Still on This Earth. If you want to join us, you can send email to think@kera.org or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Did people talk to you a lot about the philosophies of religion and faith?
They did, particularly Althea Washington, that woman who I mentioned who had lost her husband
in the
house in Katrina. Mm-hmm. She was very devout. And a couple of other folks did. What's interesting to me about wisdom is that often it supersedes religion, which is to say it's even more universal. I'm myself agnostic, and I think what draws me to wisdom is this idea that it's usually so large that it doesn't come with a lot of specific dictates. I think it's easy for a lot of people to look at organized religion and see in a lot of those religions to see a certain amount of intolerance. But that's not really the case with wisdom.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. The email address is think@kera.org. An email from Paul in Terrell says, I'll be 71 in a few weeks. It seems to me that my age group contains more embedded stupidity than I had hoped. For instance, younger voters gave us the incoming administration, and they made the right choice. Further, the richer the old folks I know, the more rigid their thinking, so worldly success does not seem to imply wisdom. So while I'm flattered by Mr. Alford's search for wisdom among us older people, I'm not all that convinced that he will find it.
Huh, that's interesting, Paul. Well, here's the thing is, I'm not saying that all people over 70 have this capacity. What I'm really trying to say is that it's the greatest time in your life to have that capacity. So the folks who do come into their own, be it through their wisdom, be it through their practicing whatever their discipline is, they're the ones who can really make huge gains. I agree. There are a lot of people whose unattractive habits or whose repugnant worldviews become hardened in old age. I think, yeah, if we can generalize, I think the movement that we see, regardless, though, is that people become more and more themselves as they get old. I'm the first one to admit that some people just aren't that great to begin with in the first hand, and for those folks, some of their things may even get worse. But for so many people, it's the opposite. It's a time when folks have finally a big amount of time to do some self-introspection, or they have the time to look into some questions that they never were able to before.
Is it your experience that there's a lot of regret built into this kind of end-of-life wisdom?
Yeah. It's not always a sunny picture, absolutely. I think that, you know, there's a big question in wisdom. Do you have to suffer in order to acquire wisdom? Personally, I don't think you do, but I think it does involve this kind of self-inventory, and a self-inventory necessarily is going to beget regrets.
You also looked at some sort of traditional philosophers. You looked at the writings of Confucius and Socrates Buddha. Did you have particular ideas from them that really stuck with you more than anything?
I did, yeah, absolutely. I think that, you know, if you look at Confucius, someone once asked him, what is wisdom? And he said, is not reciprocity such a thing? So I think he really does bring us this idea of reciprocity, which later, of course, Jesus brought up again, the idea of doing unto others as we would have them do unto us. Buddha is the first line of the Dhammapada, which Buddha wrote, is "We are what we think," and thus I think that what we can ascribe to him is non-attachment. This idea that we shouldn't fixate on the outcomes of things, that we need to allow for flux and change. And Socrates, thirdly, we get this idea of doubt, that a wise person always has a little bit of doubt, that you need to be able to say, usually when A is followed by B, it results in C. However, there's always the possibility that a large grand piano will come crashing on our heads. This idea that there's always this possibility that something could go awry, and I think that's doubt.
Well, that's so interesting too, because doubt is really all about sort of intellectual flexibility.
Yeah, it is, absolutely.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak to Zach in Fort Worth. Hi, Zach.
Hello. I have two questions. One that I formulated while listening. The first one's a quick one, and it's if you'd ever heard of the book Duplex Planet.
Of course, yes. This is David Greenberger's book, where he interviewed folks at a nursing home, and he gets them to say wonderful and woolly things.
This is a great one. The other one was, did you find anybody who said, you know, things like indulge your vices or, you know, just live it up? You know, because it's worse to regret something you haven't done than to regret something you did do.
Yeah.
And did you, or did you Were there any convicts?
I didn't speak to any convicts. By and large, I was surprised that I did not run into that. I thought that I would get someone who would say something along the lines of Oscar Wilde's quip about the only way to deal with temptation is to give in to it. There wasn't a lot of that, but maybe some people's life stories would corroborate that. What, Zach, do you think that's an important part of wisdom?
We don't have Zach on the line anymore, so we'll have to just assume that he was curious about that. It's hard to know when someone asks a question like that if we don't have them, whether they meant, clearly no one's going to say indulge all your vices, or whether he was hoping maybe that
someone would. Yes, it's true. I did have a call in on another radio show, and yes, someone asked a 92-year-old gentleman if he had a bit of advice for him, and the gentleman said to him, just be a son of a bitch. So I think that kind of thinking is out there. I think it tends to be more rhetoric. I think people are being funny in the same way that Oscar Wilde was. I'm not sure if he actually believes that.
I think one thing that's really interesting about you doing this project, and obviously you were looking for the same kind of information from everyone. What is your personal wisdom, and what do you have to sort of tell the rest of the world? But it had to have given you an opportunity to relate to people who are considerably older than you are as individuals, as opposed to this sort of group and mass that unfortunately it seems a lot of Americans seem to put the elderly in a category and assume they're sort of all one way.
Yeah, no, it's true. And there's an interesting theory in gerontology studies called the disengagement theory, which is this idea that most older folks will put themselves in an assisted living facility because they're trying to ease the transition in society when we come to the point of those folks' demise.
Hmm.
They're trying to make that transition easier. So, when we think of old folks, sometimes we do kind of group them in this kind of blurry picture. But, of course, the really interesting senior citizens are people whose lives are these crazy odysseys, and whose lives sometimes are fraught with contradiction and who have very specific life stories. So, no, I think that, obviously I stacked the deck in this book. I went looking for people who I thought were fascinating. It's not a random study where I just walk up to people on the street. And I think in trying to get their wisdom, I would try to ask them very specific stories. The actress Sylvia Miles once got a very, very nasty ad hominem review from a theater critic in New York, and so she found out about a party that he was going to be at, and she went, and she heaped up a lot of food on her plate, and she walked up to this critic, whose name is John Simon, and she dumped the food on his head. So that's the kind of story where I knew when I sat down with Sylvia Miles, I knew that I really wanted to talk to her about that. Did she learn from that? Did that change her life? And indeed, she said, I think I lost a lot of work from that. But she said she does not regret having done it for one minute.
We have time for another call, and it's Carrie in Denton. Hi, Carrie.
Hi. I recently moved back to the U.S. after living in Singapore for 12 years, and one of the things that I learned was how respectful they are of their elders and in the Chinese culture. And I was wondering if the author interviewed other people from cultures that have never lived in the U.S., and if he did, what he learned from them.
Thanks for your call.
I did talk to some folks who either had lived abroad or who knew lots about the treatment of elders in other societies. And it's true. It's I mean, that was one of the things that, excuse me, drew me to the project in the first place, was I realized Asian cultures respect elders, Latin cultures do, Native American cultures do, Pacific Rim cultures do, you know, African cultures really do, pretty much every culture except my own. And so, yeah, I think that's why this is an issue that one that needed to be brought to the fore, because, yeah, China is a terrific example that they really do pay a lot more attention to what the older folks have to say. And I think that the United States could really stand to bridge that gap.
You mentioned earlier that you're not religious, but I trust that you'll go with me on this term. Have you concluded ultimately that wisdom is a gift, or is it something that we have to earn?
Chris, you ask such big questions.
That's my job.
That's why she gets the big bucks. I think it's both, and I apologize. That sounds like I'm hedging, but I think that it requires, that it does require a skill which may be God or birth given, because I think it is not everyone's ability to self-reflect. I think there are a lot of folks who are very happy just to go through life and not, you know, penetrate and contemplate too much. So, yeah, I think there's definitely some of that. And then I think that, I think that folks who have had some adversity or have had some obstacles, yes, that very often they are the ones who are likely to come out of that particular car wash looking a little more soulful or lit up from within.
And in 10 seconds or less, do you feel optimistic about growing old?
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
No, I'm embarrassed to say I'm excited. I'm thrilled.
That's great. Henry Alford is a humor writer and a journalist. His new book is called How to Live, A Search for Wisdom from Old People While They Are Still on This Earth. Henry, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.